Welcome everyone. I'm sorry. Welcome to iDeveloper 5 episode 31. And we'd like to welcome Mr. John Fox.
Hi, Scotty. Hello, world. Hello, Nemesis Uli.
You wish you were my nemesis. I already have a nemesis, you know.
You can never have enough nemesi.
C's.
Nemesis?
Yes.
The American gets corrected.
Get it right, boy.
The American gets corrected on English pronunciation by the German.
Well, it's Latin, strictly speaking. Or Greek?
The show starts well. Well, we just want to thank everybody in the chat room for coming to listen to us today, especially Simon Wolf. Let's say hello, Simon. Who we're particularly grateful today for being here, because he's managed to pull himself away from his enormous 70s porn collection to come and listen for the day or the hour. So we're very grateful, Simon, that we rank at that level in your life. Oh, dear, somebody help me. John, I heard you bought a really good video training course this week.
I did. When I was, I'm always the last to know. Everybody who has followed the adventure of filming the cappuccino course knows the levels of abuse I put up with. And if not, I'll add that into the show notes of you kind of locking me in the closet and Dave turning me blue. I mean, just no respect. And, the course is released. I'm the last one to hear about it. And then I figured, well, I'd like to see this thing that I worked on, because I saw no edits of it. So I just bought it. But actually, I want to have to say, I thought Dave did a bang up job editing it. This one where we did it without green screen, but just against the white wall. And then how he cut in what was being shown on the screen sharing. I thought, Dave, you did a bang up job. And Scotty, my best compliment to you is that somehow you managed to hoodwink Dave into working on this.
Yes. He's easy to hoodwink. There we are. So,
speaking of hoodwinked, Willie, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. A little hoodwinked, but apart from that, okay.
In case people are okay, let's get this right before we go back to course. Our guest today is Uli Kostura. I just made the assumption everyone knew you, Uli. But Uli, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a programmer, software engineer, whatever you want to call it, senior memory manager, slayer of subversion servers, and eradicator of zombies at Elgato in Munich. And I write software for TV tuners there.
There we are. Now back to our conversation that we had before, because everyone knows who's involved now. So, John, tell us a little. I know we spoke about it before, but now it's out, and you actually purchased a copy. I've got to be. Did you purchase your own course? I still can't get over that.
Yeah, to think that, I'll see some royalty from it eventually. So after we pay for all the alcohol.
Yes, at least you'll get a percentage of that money you just sent.
Exactly, that we added as a quote-unquote business expense. No, but it was a course on cappuccino for cocoa developers. And I think it turned out rather well, actually.
Yeah, I think.
Alcohol and a course for cappuccino developers?
No, a cappuccino for cocoa developers.
Yeah, but I mean, like, where does the alcohol come in if there's already cappuccino?
Oh, no, because we alcohol was during the evening and then cappuccino was for the morning.
Ah, yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Some days you just feel you ought to start a show again, don't you? But we're not going to, because we're on a time limit here. I might be able to hoodwink Dave into editing, but I can't get him to stay here all night. Yeah, we've put the course out, and we've done it at a bargain price, I think, John, don't you?
I do. It'll be interesting to see how it goes, but since it was a course that's a little bit outside your more usual stuff, that was straight up Cocoa Touch, even though we were targeting Cocoa and Cocoa Touch developers, I think we also would like to be able to see some people who may be coming into the fold, and since a lot of people, I've seen a number of people who are classic web developers. They got into cappuccino because they wanted to build applications. They discover that once they learn the cappuccino API, that then they're in a good starting point to start doing Cocoa and Cocoa Touch work. And when they do that, then they're probably inclined to look for advanced courses on things like core data, core animation, or drawing OpenGL on your own, making the window your canvas.
Oh. There we are. That's where we're going to go in a minute. Your segue was a bit too early today, John, but never mind. Yeah, so the course is out there for $29.99. That's dollars to all of you people out there. You can get to it straight off of the iDeveloper TV homepage. And talking of which, we've released our new iDeveloper TV website, and after spending, I don't know how many days, fighting with CSS and HTML and JavaScript to make the website look good in, you know, the 75 browsers it needs to look good in, I wish, you know, I'd been using Cappuccino and Interface Builder to design that, because you really do appreciate how much work Cappuccino is doing behind the scenes to make these things look good.
Yeah. CSS is not, I mean, it is very powerful, and if you only ever had to worry about one browser, ideally WebKit, it can be actually fairly pleasant. It's very efficient, but you know, once you have to deal with the slight differences in multiple browsers, I do not envy you. But I will say, you know, in all honesty, I think the site looks great, it performs nicely. I'm sure that you probably have a little nits that you're getting out, but I think Marcello did, once again, a bang-up job with the design, so wrinkly P all the way.
Yeah, working with a designer on something, it's, you know, sometimes you're there and thinking, oh, that's only a pixel out, leave me alone. But then, you know, the fact that there's that person looking over your shoulder who not only, first of all, has the taste to make, you know, to design something that looks good, but actually, because their name is going to go somewhere on the site, you know, wants to make sure their work is represented well, it actually really means you just battle on through and get it right. And I think in some ways, having that person over your shoulder is almost worth paying for in its own right.
I think that very technique of forcing people to put your name on it is a good way to assure quality. I think the Russian aerospace program, that the people who designed it were also the first people to fly it. So I think fly it is something, so that's a good way of doing it.
Let's not go there. So we'd love your comments on the new iDeveloper TV website. I'm really pleased with it, and there's not everything there yet that we want to put there, but it's the basics are there, and we've done some restructuring behind the scenes and everything. It's still fundamentally Rails for the content delivery system and everything, but a lot more static stuff, so the performance should be a little bit better, and we've got a sort of a process we're going to use now to add stuff to it, which means hopefully the quality will remain as good throughout its lifetime and not diminish over the coming years as I keep deciding to add stuff to it.
Well, there are a lot of little details. I mean, and this is something that's germane to marketing. I mean, you know, these days with people sharing as much as they do, you know, on Google Plus or Facebook, I think there is an art and science to making a web page, giving clues to Facebook and Google to be able to say what, you know, what images may be available. Because if you post something on a wall or Google Plus, you know, I don't know what they call it, but anyway, a Google Plus stream. When you pass in a URL, they do their best to be able to figure out what's the best image to represent you know the page you're linking to. And I have a feeling, I haven't looked into it, but I have a feeling there's a way that you can add in some meta tags or something like that that will, you know, give it a clue and let you have some control over it. Because I noticed that when I was posting on a Facebook wall about that page, you know, it said the thumbnails that were available for it was, you know, just about me, the presenter, and nothing else about the course or anything like that. So that's, I think that anybody who has a web page for their indie app and they want it to make it very friendly for people to share and help build hype, these are little tiny details that are worth having a look into.
Oh, right. I didn't realize. I'll have to look into that. That's useful. Thanks, John.
Yeah.
That's good. So we spoke about this a little bit last time. You got Memory Miner onto the App Store and all that's running, I'm assuming, okay now. So, you know, what's next for you, John?
Well, I'm trying to get out a release actually that you know the version that's up there 2.2 is Lion compatible, but it doesn't really take advantage of any Lion specific features. I mean, the app has been full, you know, had full screen mode since 2.0, but there are Lion specific ways you can do it, and it's a little bit tricky because in order to really start taking advantage of Lion features, I need to be able to do all my development work under Lion, and well, more specifically Xcode, you know, 4.2. And if I want to do things like auto layout, then yeah, I have to use Lion and Lion only APIs. But since we all know Lion, you know, since Xcode 4.2, you don't have support for Interface Builder plugins anymore. My app made very, very extensive use of RB Split View, and I'm certainly not the only one. I mean, and so I've had to redo all this work using NS Split View, and I didn't even do the work. I have somebody help me with on it. And NS Split View sucks less than it used to, but it's still not nearly as good as RB Split View, and it made me appreciate what an incredible, incredible contribution Rainer Brockeroff made by making this stuff, making it incredibly well documented, fantastic delegate methods so that you could hook in and do some interesting drawing, you know, when your split view is up and running to be displayed. But that's a lot of work. And once that's done, then I'm in a position to kind of bring the app forward. And I think I'll eventually, I'm going to go line only for it. But, you know, in order to get to all these pieces and get ready for it, I have once again facing a kind of a business and technical decision of how much more work I do for, you know, existing users before I say this is line only. And similarly, you know, since Memory Miner publishes to MobileMe and MobileMe is going away, I have to find a substitute for it. And it seems like Dropbox is the best option for that, since people can get it and it's free. And unlike iCloud, there really is a public space for serving out web content. And happily enough, they've updated their API, their RESTful API, and also their Objective-C, you know, front end to it, and I found it quite pleasant to work with. So I have a lot of work to do to get some new releases out, but I finally feel that, as I said last week, I'm in a position where it's worth doing it for the App Store, because I know that I'm on the App Store and presumably updates will get accepted as well.
That raises a couple of points for me. Feel free to chip in here, Uli, as well, and anyone in the chat room as well. Do you, this whole thing with, RB Split View is used in loads of applications, and also what's the tool set that a lot of people
use? There's a BW toolkit.
One. Brandon Walkins toolkit. A lot of people use those. They use them as plugins in Interface Builder. Do you think Xcode is ever going to support plugins again? Do you think this is something they've, we're now at 4.2. When 4 came out, it was understandable. Maybe it's all new. We're at 4.2. We've not seen plugins. Are plugins, are Apple saying we don't want custom controls that plug in, you've got to do it all in code and whatever else? Do you think we're ever going to see a plug-in architecture again for Xcode?
I keep hearing different things, and I've spoken to a bunch of people, and I know that there are some companies like animation studios that do a lot of internal application development, and I don't see how they can get away with not having it. I've heard lots of explanations or theorized why they haven't done it, but I think they'll probably eventually get around to it. But who can afford to wait? Who knows how long it's going to be? And that's the thing. It's like, for very good business reasons, now that the Mac App Store is out and we see that Apple's real growth is coming from countries that aren't, on the brink of financial collapse, like, Western Europe and North America, or at least United States. So if you want to start selling it in countries where they have money and are buying consumer goods and consumer stuff, you need to be localized. And the way to be localized efficiently is to use auto layout. So it's been a really tricky thing. Uli, do you think there's going to be plugins ever?
I don't know. I think it's the problem always was that not that many plugins were made. And I mean, you have these new Xcode, what are they called? You can essentially set key value pairs in Xcode now in the interface builder. Mm. There's like in the object info somewhere, there is a thing where you can say this property and this string or this number or whatever,
right,
and then just call set value for key on it. And I think that's probably what we will have. And I don't think that we will get much more than that unless some other really big use case comes along where it suddenly becomes easy and attractive and worthwhile again for more developers than before to write their own IB plugins.
Yeah, but I think it's kind of a bummer that there's no way of having it render. I mean, I think RB Split View was one issue. I mean, the way that they did the layout and their views were always flipped. When I was at DubDub this past summer, I went and sat in the IB lab and sat with an engineer, and he said, well, here's a technique you can do to force it to load your nib file even if the plugin's not there, but the layout is all flipped and broken, so you can't really work with it at all. That's kind of a no-op for that one. For other types of toolkits, like I used, I forgot the name of it, but somebody's HUD toolkit that doesn't use images or anything like that. It's all gradient drawn and whatnot. And in that particular case, if you don't have the plugin loaded, well, you get it rendered as a kind of as it's superclass. You get it some garden variety NS button and not a HUD specific one. So that you can kind of live with. It's just a little bit suboptimal. But I guess there aren't aren't that many plugins, but there are a few. And I think the important thing is that those that are there, I think, seem to have been pretty widely used. So, and I have to believe that Apple internally uses a lot of plugins. I mean, you know, there's this thing ProKit that's used for all their professional apps, which is a completely different look and feel. And I would have to imagine those were done with plugins. Maybe I'm wrong, but I thought they would be.
Yeah, but of course, Apple works by different rules. They can just
no way, no way, no, 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 no. Uli, please, please stop.
All right, I'm going to move this conversation on again now because I mean it's speculation, okay. The other thing that you raised in your talk there, John, about the future of Memory Miner, which was a little while ago now, hopefully, was the whole thing. You're looking at Dropbox because you need to be able to post stuff that can be shared, and iCloud doesn't support sharing. Do you think, iCloud is only ever going to be this closed, private thing, or do we see sharing sometime in its future? I mean, it's like a backward step. Mobile Me stuff that had sharing and all this public space is all gone. The reality is people always used to complain about it was slow or didn't work or whatever else. Have they just said, well, scrap that stuff, we don't want all the complaints? Or do you think this is first release and we're going to see sharing later on? Because yeah, it's great, but sometimes if you can't get to that data, then yeah, there's a lot of power in Dropbox and be able to share stuff publicly and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is just pure speculation, I would like to believe, but you know, this is a theme that's been discussed a number of years, is, you know, how well does Apple get web services? And their track record, unfortunately, isn't all that great. It sure seems to be better. I mean, and they just, you know, dealt with a sea of activations and whatnot, and had a little trouble with there, but I think those hiccups got worked out, and the volume was beyond what they expected. But then, you know, they are building some critical aspects for it. Siri simply does not work if it doesn't have access to, you know, some servers. So somewhere in North Carolina, some people are up late at night trying to keep these things up and running and provision that. So I would like to believe that they're starting with the minimum that they can possibly do in classic Apple style, and then adding things in. The problem is that, you know, people can't always wait. You know, there is that kind of artificial deadline that Mobile Me disappears, you know, in whenever.
30th of June 2012, isn't it?
Right. So it's not all that long time away. So they have to ship it, have to get the things worked out. And then, these things are fairly – there are a lot of kind of quote-unquote professional users who live and die by having the ability to share stuff, whether you're a web designer or an author or whatever. So for those types of people, they have Dropbox. And so, you know, in some ways it would be nice to not have to deal with, oh, I use Dropbox for sharing, but iCloud, you know, services for everything else. It would kind of behoove Apple to get all these things running, but they still, I think, have to work a little bit more to get their sea legs, so to speak, with providing rock solid web services.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I don't know.
I agree that.
Go on, Uli, after you.
I was basically just agreeing. No problem.
Okay. I mean, it's going to be interesting now. You know, we were on a week ago, and we were all talking about our fond memories of Steve Jobs and the amazing stuff he did at Apple. However, you know, there are two bits he never really got. He managed to pull off. I won't say he got wrong, but he never managed to pull off, wasn't there? One is the mouse. and I'm just wondering if the next mouse we see from Apple has 82 buttons on it just to make up for the last 25 years. and the other really was that I'm not going to say the web, because they got iTunes. I mean, they got a content delivery service. I mean, they're doing some stuff with volumes that just make people wince. Yet that personal web experience, they never quite got right. And I have to say, my first experience of iCloud was a bit shocking. I was on my upgrading my Mobile Me account to iCloud, and it just said, you know, make sure you back up your contacts or whatever. I was thinking, yeah, well, he always says make a backup or whatever, but just in case something goes wrong. But no, back up your contacts, because we are going to wipe them when we do the conversion. So hundreds of contacts from my Mac and my iPhone all just disappeared at one press of a button in there again. I'm just thinking, well, yeah, if I'm a standard user without a lot of tech, you know, that's just peed me off. and yeah. It peed me off anyway. And I have to, I can play back through backups and find them and get them back. In fact, I haven't changed the iPad yet, so I'm going to shift them all over from there. But yeah, it's, the start for me, maybe this is just me personally, wasn't that promising, I have to say.
Yeah, it's too bad Google and Apple don't love each other so much anymore, because I think Google gets, they get web services, they don't get user experience, but they're getting better at user experience, and Apple's getting better at web services, so who knows.
But honestly, I think web services are easier than usability, so...
I think so. I think I agree on that.
Right, okay, well, before we... move into the next section, which where we're going to give Uli the chance to just talk about a bunch of stuff. I'm just going to talk a little bit about a book that was released recently, Mastering Xcode 4 by Joshua Nozzi. We've got a bunch of coupon codes that we're going to give away over the next few weeks for people to get free copies of this book. I'm not quite decided how yet, but what I have decided is I'm going to give one away each week to someone in the chat room who's listening live, and then someone who emails in. That's Mastering Xcode 4. You can go look it up on Amazon and see what the contents and everything are on there. These are e-books we're giving away, not the physical ones, because e-books are far easier to deal with the delivery of. So what I'm going to do is we're going to go into a section now on that Uli's going to talk about some stuff, and at the end of the section I'm going to ask a question, and the first person in the chat room to answer that question can get a coupon code. I mean, this is how people are going to listen to you, Uli. They are going to stay awake, they're going to keep their eyes open because they want one of these books. Oh, and of course, because what you'll say is interesting.
Good that you tell me that.
Right, Uli, what are we going to talk about today?
I guess the epic name that you could take for it is The Screen is Your Canvas. So essentially, I'm talking about custom windows and how you would draw anywhere on the screen where you want.
Okay, so where are we going to start? How far back are we going to go?
I guess it would be best to go way down to the basics and just say, let's first start with a little overview of how your Mac does all this stuff with Windows and the desktop and everything. So there is this separate process, actually, so kind of like a second application called the Windows Server. And what that essentially does is it takes care of displaying all your windows. And when your application is launched and it's a GUI application, then what it actually does is it establishes an inter-process connection to that process and sends it messages saying, I need a window of that size, put these pixels in there, resize the window, and of course gets messages from the Windows Server back like, ooh, your window just moved or something like that. Yeah. So... now that you, it sounds like it's a lot of overhead, but it's actually the thing that makes it possible to have things like there is an application that has actually hung, but all the windows can still be dragged around, because like dragging windows is usually, not always, but usually handled by the Windows Server for you. And So while your application is busy spinning its endless loop, the Windows Server can actually just shift around those few pixel buffers.
Oh, I feel so much more comforted to know that my application can be stuck, but people can still move the windows. That's a better user
experience.
Well,
it's useful.
I am joking.
Well, yeah. But I mean, it's a great thing. I don't think you go back to that time, but you go back there, but not your Mac career. But on OS 9, this wasn't the case. So what happened was when any application hung, your Mac was just screwed because everything hung. But the thing is that if you can't asynchronously move windows in the Windows Server, you get things like one huge dead spot in the middle of your screen. You can kind of get that experience if you have a full screen application that hangs, because until a couple of system versions ago, there was essentially no way to get out of there again, because the only way to quit this application was to type command option escape. And when you did that, of course, it wouldn't, it would just show a window asking you which application to quit. Now, in the more modern system version, the OS actually detects that case and just shoots down the frontmost application that is covering everything, so you're actually better off. But there are still some cases, if you make your own full screen windows, where you can shoot yourself into the foot very well.
Okay, so we've got a Windows Server. What next do we need to know?
Yeah, well, the Windows Server, of course. So what is a window? How does the Windows Server actually do Windows on a lower level? And the best way, I guess, to think of this, and the most popular API that some people might have used already, is OpenGL. You know that OpenGL is essentially a drawing API, and what you can do there is you can create textures, which are essentially just blocks of memory containing a bunch of pixels. And you can create polygons, which are essentially, well, rectangular or even slightly skewed shapes. And you can apply a texture to such a polygon. And what that does is it just draws those pixels in a rectangle on the screen. So what you can do there now, and that's essentially what a window is. A window is essentially an OpenGL surface, so just a rectangle full of pixels. And what happens when you change something inside a window is that the window server gets the pixels that are currently displayed on the graphics card back, hands it to your application, lets Quartz mess with the pixels, and then takes those pixels again, uploads them again to the graphics card, and displays them as a polygon. And the nice thing about this is that since you have the intermediary, the Windows Server, and you have these texture buffers, what the Windows Server can, for example, do is you can disable screen updates temporarily. There is a function called ns-disable screen updates and ns-enable screen updates that you can use for that. And you can use those calls to just keep the Windows Server from uploading the pixels to the graphics card. And then the graphics card will... I'm simplifying criminally here, but essentially what will happen is that nothing on the screen changes for a moment. You can shuffle around stuff and resize windows and do other things, and then afterwards cause it to redraw, and everything is just in there in one piece and at the same moment.
So this is all going on through the Windows Server. Why do I, as a developer, need to care?
Well, the important thing here is that this has an effect on performance in your application. Because if you have a big window and you change only a single pixel in that, what happens is that the entire pixel has to the entire pixel buffer. So the entire shape of the window has to be uploaded to the graphics card again. And usually when people do animations, when people use Quartz, that's one of the major bottlenecks. On the Mac, it's not quite as severe because the Mac is just blazingly fast. On the iPhone, this is regularly what kills you. Even though on the iPhone you don't have Windows, but the thing is that one of those OpenGL surfaces on the Mac is represented essentially by a CA layer. And by default on the Mac, traditionally, one window was one layer, and later Apple introduced layers you could actually use for smaller areas inside a window, like NS views that are layer-backed or just creating your own layer tree. And when they created the iOS UI kit, they actually went, okay, we'll just make that the default. Every view is a layer. And so that means every view on the iPhone that you have is a texture and is something that needs to be uploaded to the graphics card to be displayed on the screen.
Right, and just one small change to that view causes the whole thing to go back to the graphics card.
The whole view in the case of an iPhone UI view or a layer-backed view, but the whole window in the case of standard Quartz-based NS view drawing on the Mac, yes.
Okay, so but I've still got to change my view. So, I mean, it's good that I'm aware of that, but yeah, I'm jumping ahead. Where do you want to go next? And if I've still got my question a minute, I'll ask it again.
Yeah. So now the thing is, of course, with that, we only have a window, like nothing special in it. So what actually happens when you create a window? Well, essentially, if you create, for example, an NS window, then AppKit creates a new layer and puts views into it, which are just by default just draw into this this one single layer. And what it, for example, does is it decorates the window. So it creates a view that draws the background of the window, for instance. It creates three views for the close box, for the minimize box, for the zoom box. It creates another view in the upper right for the full screen widget, and sets up things so that you can drag the window. So just declares certain areas of the window as the title area or the draggable area, so that the Windows server knows when the user clicks there. I don't even have to ask the application. I can just move around this texture's coordinates. And the advantage of this, of course, is the texture itself doesn't change. It only draws the texture at a different spot. So it's actually a lot faster to drag around a window than to drag around a view inside a window.
Right, okay. Going back to where we were just now, a question on the chat room is, can't you just do a draw rect refresh over a region that isn't the full window, or does that still trigger a full send of the data to the GPU?
Yeah, the draw rect case, draw rect only redraw, the quartz effort that is put into it, like calculating the actual pixels to draw and actually changing the pixels in the buffer of the layer. Those get selectively changed in that rectangle, but the whole layer still gets uploaded.
Right, so it selectively changes the bits in it, but then uploads the whole thing.
I think I'm actually lying. I think there is actually, at least in OpenGL, I recall there is actually a way to update part of a texture. But it's still, you know, you still update whole scan lines and things like that, so you're still updating a bunch more, like the whole width of the view or something like that, instead of just the height. So it's still not super efficient. DrawRect helps you when your actual drawing code is complex, but it doesn't really help you with the graphics card side of things that much. I mean, DrawRect actually comes from the times where from the Next OS, which didn't even have layers originally, and just had like one huge screen buffer and drew stuff into that. And when you moved a window, it would actually call draw rect with the exposed area and redraw only that.
Right, okay. So there's some historical stuff in there as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so what next? What do you want to tell us? How do you want to educate us next?
Yeah, so I guess what we know is now that essentially everything on the screen is a texture, and we're not drawing directly into a back buffer anymore like we used to do on Next or on classic Mac OS or on the C64 or Apple II or any older system. But what we're actually doing is we're only drawing into textures, and those get composited by the so-called quartz compositor, which I guess we could call is just a part of the Windows server. Gets composited onto the screen. So what do we do if we want to actually draw on the screen? Because we want to use the screen as our canvas. We want to do fun things like, for example, if you look in Interface Builder, when you drag an outlet connection to a view, you could actually do that across several windows, at least in the classic Interface Builder that had several windows. So how did they do that? Well, the thing is, everything has to be a window. So the trick for drawing on the desktop is simply to create an invisible window, a fully transparent window. Now, you can't really do that so to draw a completely transparent window, what you actually do is just you create a borderless window. There is, when you create a new NS window, there is an NS borderless window flag that you can set that kind of doesn't create the title bar view and doesn't create the zoom box views and other things like that, all the window decorations, and just essentially gives you a texture and a root view. And So this one you can then place anywhere on the screen where you want. And the one trick that many people forget when they create a borderless window is you still have to tell the window that it is not opaque, because as an optimization, it is usually assumed that the whole window is opaque, or at least mostly opaque, so that there is... So it doesn't have to composite the pixels behind the fully opaque areas in the window. And similarly, a view has an isOpaque method that when returning yes will turn on certain optimizations so that views behind that view don't have to be drawn, which, funnily, doesn't... Well, actually, it exists on iOS as well, yeah. So UIView actually also has an isOpaque method that you can use to optimize drawing if you know that you're not using any transparency or alpha compositing or anything, if you're only drawing in every pixel in this rectangular area. So the trick is to create your view and your window and set it to be not opaque, because otherwise... when you fill the rectangle with the clear color, all you get is black, because essentially what would be the backmost pixels, when you draw something and if they're transparent, the alpha of those gets ignored in an opaque view. And if you look at clear color, it's an RGB color that actually has its red, green, blue, and alpha set to zero. That essentially means you have a completely black color that is completely transparent, so you don't actually see the black. So if you fill an area with clear color and alpha is ignored, all you get is the black.
Right. Okay. So if it thinks the window is opaque, it ignores the alpha for performance reasons, so you get a black one. But if you set the window to not be opaque, then clear color effectively still does black, but then has the alpha of zero.
Yeah, exactly, and that's why it's invisible. Of course, if you look at, for example, NSFillRect, the drawing mode it uses is something like NSCompositeAtop or something like that. So a drawing mode that actually, a compositing mode that actually honors alpha. So if you use NSFillRect, with clear color being the current color, you're essentially doing nothing, because you're drawing black at 0% opacity, so you're not changing a pixel. That's what happens to many people who try to use NSRectFill or NSFillRect or whatever it was called for erasing an area of the screen to transparency so they have a hole in their window. And what you have to do instead is use NSRectFill using operation, which lets you specify an operation, and then you can use the copy operation, which means just obliterate anything that is in the buffer in that rectangle, in the texture.
That's worth knowing.
And that's what you use to create a transparent view. Essentially, you first draw the whole background with clear color, and then you have a completely invisible window with a completely invisible content view. And the window is just as large as the content view, so there's no decorations or anything to take up space. And then you can just arbitrarily draw into that view, and it'll look as if it's directly on the desktop.
Ba-boom. We're done. What was there other stuff we need to know?
I wish. Yeah, there's a few more problems and one more feature. Another problem is that if you create such a window, by default, every window in Cocoa gets constrained to the screen. There is a method constrain window to screen, and that gets called by NSWindowController and by other places, and when the screen arrangement changes, things like that. And what it does, among other things, is move windows away from the dock so they don't end up underneath the dock, or move them out from under the menu bar, things like that. So... if you actually want to create a window that is transparently overlaid over the menu bar, for instance, a very old application, but it's the first application I can think of, HyperCard, used to draw like dashed lines over the menu bar when you were editing templates, so that you immediately knew, I'm in template editing mode. I'm not editing the actual content of my database. I'm editing the form with the fields and things like that. And what they back then did is just they drew directly into the back buffer and hoped that the menu manager would not obliterate their pixels, which actually worked in classic macOS because all it did was save the pixels and then restore them later. But in our case, of course, that wouldn't work because the menu bar can change quickly and there can be status items and other things in the menu bar that update live. So you actually want to put a transparent window over that menu bar and just do your drawing on there. And then you can scribble all you want and you can see it. But the problem is constrained window to screen will move that away and will pop that down to lie under the menu bar. And for that, you can look at there is a method in NS Window itself. I think it's something like constrained rect, closed Xcode for efficiency. Well, anyway, so there's a method in NS Window that lets you actually set the constraint and specify how whether your window should be constrained or not. And essentially, it gets a rectangle. And great, Xcode is indexing. Oh, now I have it. And it takes a rectangle and moves and then the method is called constrain frame rect to screen, and it takes a rect and a screen and returns a rect again. So if you don't want your window to be constrained, then just return the frame rect from that method again. So the frame rect that it gave you. And otherwise, you can do things like move it away when it would end up in the dock or things like that. That's a useful method to know about. And another thing that is helpful when you're creating these windows, these transparent windows, there are different uses you have for them. For example, you might want to create a window that actually highlights a menu like KN App Guide by Daniel Kennett does it. It draws like little red marker marks, coach marks around certain menu items to tell you, okay, click this menu now or things like that. And to do that, of course, if you take a document window, it will always end up under the menu bar. But for that, you have window levels. So every window has a set level method, and you can just specify one of several constants like NS document window level, NS floating window level, NS utility window level. I think there is a whole bunch of them. And you can just specify, I think there's even a menu or menu bar window level. You can take any of those and just set it to those, and then it will suddenly float atop even the dock if you want. There's even a dock window level. If you can't find a window level in the Cocoa header, which I think is NS Window, then you can actually... I can't find it right now, or I would have told you which header it's in. I have it. Wait. So it's in nswindow.h, and there's a bunch of window levels, but if you look at them, then they're just defined to CG window levels. So you can actually look in the cgwindow.h header, I think. Oh, my Xcode index is completely screwed right now. I think it's CG window. No, actually, it isn't cgwindow.h. Well, there is a core graphics header with constants for each of these. You can just command click them and see for yourself. But there's like kcg normal window level, kcg floating window level, and essentially they map to a function call. They used to be hard coded constants, but were changed to function calls later. You could just pass those flags in, and they tell you at which in which layer your windows should be.
So this sounds very abstract right now. So of course there is a layer for floating windows, there is a layer for the main menu, so the menu bar, for instance. There is a window, a level for status windows, which is essentially the status items in the upper right. There is a separate window level for modal panels, which is interesting because it can actually change, like a modal panel can be in front of a floating window while your application is active, but of course it shouldn't float above everything while your application is inactive. So at least in older system versions, they used to actually change what this window level meant depending on whether your application is currently active or not. One interesting window level, for example, is the dock icon window level. So actually the Finder creates a separate window in its own layer for holding the dock icons, desktop icons. So, and then behind that, it creates the desktop window, which also has its own desktop window level. So what you can actually do is you can create a window that comes to lie behind the desktop icons, but in front of the desktop background. And that's, for example, what the screensaver does if you start it in desktop background mode. It will just slip a window in between and do its magic there.
Wow, I never knew all those levels were there and that complicated.
Yeah, but they're really useful because, I mean, usually it's enough to just set the checkbox, this is a floating window. But, for example, there isn't just floating window levels. You have, they used to be called utility windows. I'm not quite sure whether they still are. This happens a little differently in Carbon and Cocoa, so I might be a little mixed up. But the one thing is that you can have floating windows that float just in your application, and you can have utility windows, is what they used to be called to distinguish them, which actually float above every application. So this is like, for example, the speech recognizer window that you get if you use Plain Talk. So this stuff is quite useful if you want to put special drawing somewhere. Like if you want something to look as if it was part of another window, you can actually find out what window level that window is on, and then and you can even add a little like +1 to a window level to have your window guaranteed to be, for example, in front of the dock, but not in front of everything else that is farther up. So there are actually gaps between the different window levels that you can use for your own nefarious purposes.
Like faking a plugin for an application that doesn't support plugins?
For example, yes.
Now, Uli, I know you've got a bit more you want to talk about, but we're sort of running out of time here. In fact, we're already slightly over time because we started a little bit... we talked about a bit of stuff beforehand before letting you in. So we can make a choice here right now. We can either rush through what's left in the next few minutes, or we can say, well, let's bring you back in a couple of weeks and do a part two. Which would you prefer to do?
I think it should be short enough to just rush through it.
Go for it then.
Okay, so if you drag one more thing that you can do is you can drag a window, like a textured window, which used to be brushed metal before, by its window background. And this is actually fairly easy to decide which views should work for dragging, even if it's a custom view you created yourself, because there's a method, is draggable by window background or something like that. A drag moves windows? Can't find it. No matter. So there is actually a method from which you can just return yes, and then you can drag a window not only by the background, which is a flag on NSWindow, but you can actually decide your view should do that. if in some cases you can't do that because this is an all or nothing thing. You don't get to look at the event and say, okay, this event is actually inside like an element of my view that can be clicked, and this event is actually in a transparent area. That doesn't work. So in those cases, what you have to do is override mouse down and write your own loop code that calls next event matching mask, and whenever the mouse moves, just moves the window along and calls constrain window on it. The one important thing that you want to do there is you want to use the right run loop mode when you do this. Next event matching mask, I think, takes a run loop mode, and there is the NS event tracking mode that you can use for that. Also, another thing that you can use for lots of custom things is, especially if you're like injected into another application and trying to do a plugin like John mentioned before, you can add child windows to an existing Windows. This is how, for example, drawers were implemented. As soon as a window is a child window and you add it with the add child window method, it will move whenever your other window is moved. So the Windows server will just see these two windows as a unit. This is also used, for example, for popovers. If you don't have them set to immediately hide, then dragging the window will move the popover along. Now there's one gotcha there, and that is if you're hiding a child window and it's still attached to the parent window, it will hide both windows, which in some cases can royally screw you over if the host application didn't expect that. So always detach your child window temporarily before you move or hide it, or your parent window will come along with it. And the last thing is the window widgets, as I mentioned, are just views. They're actually an NS button, a private NS button subclass. So what you can actually do is you can ask NS window, it has a class method, for the proper window button to use for your window. And then it will create a new fresh window button that has most of the right behaviors. I think the only thing that doesn't work is the mouse overs, which you have to do with your own tracking area. So you can actually just create your own window widgets and place them anywhere in the window where you want, like iTunes does it, where it had the window widgets arranged vertically or things like that. Of course, the question is that recommended? Well, when Apple changes the look of a window or something, you might get a weird surprise, get the wrong button. What is if on 10.7 you ask for a toolbar button? There are no toolbar buttons anymore. You might just get nil back. But so you can actually create a completely custom window yet still use the standard window widgets.
Well, Uli, that's been I find that really interesting. Hopefully our audience have as well. I know we've just pushed you through that quite fast, and I'm sure people have got lots of questions, but well, tough luck. They can, you know, you've given them loads of stuff to start with, and so thank you very much. We're going to start the wrap up now, but I'll just ask a question for the chat room so that they can try and win that book. Uli, if you could just tell us again where people can find you and read your blog and follow your tweets and everything, and while you're doing that, hopefully the chat room, someone will be telling me what the RGB and alpha is of clear color.
You can find my blog on orangejuiceliberationfront.com.
Sorry, say that again.
And orangejuiceliberationfront.com.
Is that like squeezing the pulp out of software development or something?
The domain was still free, so how could I do and not take it? Some of that will redirect to my old zathras.de website, where I still have some code. I'm also on GitHub as Uli Witness. I'm on, what is it, the question thing?
Quora?
Forgot the name. No, the older one.
Stack Overflow? Oh.
No. Whatever it was. I think I have a link.
You know about it so much. You're always on there.
So if people want to, yeah, nobody asked me questions there, so I just thought I'd mention that. And of course, I'm on Twitter as Uli Witness. So Yeah, and I have the C tutorial, which sadly hasn't been updated for Xcode 4 yet, but it's in the works, which is called Masters of the Void. You can just type in Masters of the Void in oneword.com, and it'll redirect you a couple of times to the right page. So if anyone of you hasn't learned C yet, okay, never mind.
Okay, thank you, Uli. John?
What was the question?
Who are you?
I like long walks on the beach and romantic movies. No, you can always find me at memoryminer.com. It's my product, Memory Miner. I blog about it at memoryminer.com/blog. And you can find me on Twitter as Djembe. And actually, you know, I did write a blog article, a post a couple of years ago about using the Windows server to save me from a problem that I had. It was kind of my last-ditch attempt to be able to solve a compositing problem, and it worked. So sometimes brute force using the Windows server can solve your problem.
Excellent. And congratulations to MB Josh in the chat room, who is our book winner this week. If you're listening to the show on the feeds, or you're in the chat room and you just weren't fast enough with the answer to the question, and you'd like to go in the draw for this week's book, then please just send me an email, scotty@ideveloper.tv, and make the subject book draw. That's book draw. And I need to receive that by the end of day on the, let's say, the 23rd of October, and we'll announce the winner on next week's show. Oh, it's been a race, but we've got there. My name is Scotty. You can follow me on Twitter at MacDevNet. Please check out all our video courses at ideveloper.tv. Next week's show, Simon Wolf is going to drag himself away from his 70s porn collection and come and talk to us about AV Foundation. Hey, that's just worked out why he spends so much time with video codecs and doing video for the iPad. He's digitizing his collection, isn't he?
Exactly.
It's research for work. He has a completely legitimate reason.
He's working it all out. Well, he's going to come and share his 70s porn digitization experiences with us next week. He may even be here in the studio. Simon, we look forward to seeing just you.
Fully clothed, hopefully.
Yes, fully clothed, please. Oh, we start as badly as we finish. No, we finish as badly as we started. I've no idea what we're doing here. That's right. Thank you for listening, everybody. And thank you, John, for being on board. Uli, that was fantastic. Thank you very much. And until next
time. Thank you, Uli.
Pleasure.
And until next time,
bye-bye.
You all take care. The top of 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 the top of